From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Terry McMillan's best-selling novel, Waiting to Exhale, has been made into a new movie starring Whitney Houston and Angela Bassett. The story is based on McMillan's and her friends' volatile romantic relationships. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Terry McMillan talks about relationships. Also today, actor Michael J. Fox. He made a name for himself portraying the teenaged conservative Alex Keaton on Family Ties. Now in the movie The American President, he plays a character not unlike the famous young liberal George Stephanopoulos. Ken Tucker reviews a collection of recordings by an often overlooked country music star, Gene Shepherd. And film critic Steve Weinberg reviews the new Othello. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Senate has unanimously approved a temporary spending bill that would allow government checks to go out to millions of veterans, welfare recipients, and foster parents, checks that would otherwise have been delayed by the partial government shutdown. The measure would also allow the District of Columbia government to keep operating. The bill now goes to the House, where approval is expected later today. At the White House, President Clinton is meeting with GOP congressional leaders in an attempt to find a final solution to the budget impasse. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton, House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole are being briefed by budget officials on a series of alternative plans that would balance the budget in 7 years. The president said he was prepared to keep working until an agreement was reached.
I am pleased that our representatives met yesterday. They did make some progress. Obviously, a lot of the biggest issues remain, but the process seemed to be working, and I'm encouraged, and I want to continue to do it until we reach agreement on a balanced budget. That's what I think clearly we all want.
For the first time since the partial government shutdown began, the president did not make a plea to reopen the government. House Republicans have refused to allow government employees back to work until the president agrees to a balanced budget plan, and the president appears to have accepted their terms. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
At least 48 U.S. citizens were believed to be on board the American Airlines flight that crashed in Colombia, according to the State Department. State Department spokesman Nicholas Burns says two American citizens are among the handful of survivors from the crash. The plane's flight data recorder was recovered from the wreckage today. Investigators are hoping it will hold some clues about the cause of the crash. Search crews are still looking for the plane's cockpit voice recorder. At the United Nations, preparations are underway for the deployment of an international police force in Bosnia. The move comes after the Security Council voted unanimously to send the force in an effort to reassure Serbs living in the suburbs of Sarajevo. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The force will be the largest ever deployed by the United Nations. A total of 1,700 policemen drawn from around the world will both patrol the streets of Sarajevo's Serb quarters as well as help to train local police forces. There has been concern among local Serbs that they could be open to reprisals once the area comes under Muslim Croat control, as stipulated in the Dayton Peace Accord. Local Serb leaders are resisting the transfer of control and have stepped up a political campaign to block it. The Muslim-led Bosnian government has given assurances that ordinary Serb civilians will be safe and only those who took part in the shelling of Sarajevo will be punished. Over 10,000 people, mainly Muslims, died in the siege. But many Serbs are unconvinced and fear for their safety once the Bosnian Serb army withdraws. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 8 points at 5,104 in active trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite is up 3. This is NPR News. The Senate has joined the House in overriding President Clinton's veto of a bill restricting securities fraud lawsuits. It was the first veto override of the Clinton administration. Many corporations, especially high-tech firms, claim they have been burdened by frivolous lawsuits filed by stockholders that have forced them into multi-million-dollar settlements and hurt their ability to grow and create jobs. The administration had argued that the bill might keep shareholders from filing legitimate lawsuits. A moderate earthquake rocked portions of Northern California this morning, but caused no injuries or damage. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Eve Perlman reports.
The quake's epicenter was near Lake Tahoe, an area where many tourists go to ski and gamble, but which otherwise is sparsely populated. Although the jolt measured 4.8 on the Richter scale, police say the only calls they've received have been from people calling out of curiosity. Area resident Bill Henderson.
A couple of the fellows that I worked out with this morning, it didn't even wake one of them up, and he was located just about 5 or 6 miles from what is supposedly the epicenter, and the other fellow that woke him up just briefly. So it compared to what we had about a year and a half ago, this was very mild.
The quake a year and a half ago measured 6.3 and shook residents up for nearly a minute, but also caused no injuries or major damage. For National Public Radio, I'm Eve Perlman in San Francisco.
The House has decided not to limit the income its members may earn from book deals. A rule adopted today by the House allows lawmakers unlimited book royalties as long as they do not accept in advance and have their book contracts cleared by the Ethics Committee. The rule only affects House Speaker Newt Gingrich at present. The Ethics Committee today named a Washington attorney as special counsel in the investigation of Speaker Gingrich. James Cole is a former Justice Department prosecutor who specializes in white-collar crime. Some observers had expected the panel to choose a tax law expert for the job of looking into the college course that Gingrich taught. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, Waiting to Exhale, is based on a best-selling novel by Terry McMillan. She also co-wrote the screen adaptation. Waiting to Exhale tells the story of four women whose friendships support them through their troubled relationships with men. As McMillan puts it, each of the four women is waiting to exhale, waiting for the man who will take her breath away. The movie stars Whitney Houston and Angela Bassett. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have an interview with Terry McMillan recorded in 1992, just after the publication of Waiting to Exhale. McMillan is also the author of the novels Mama and Disappearing Acts and the editor of an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction called Breaking Ice. When I spoke with her, I asked her to read from Waiting to Exhale.
Right now, I'm supposed to be all geeked up because I'm getting ready for a New Year's Eve party that some guy named Lionel invited me to. Sheila, my baby sister, insisted on giving me his phone number because he lives here in Denver, and her simpleton husband played basketball with him 11 years ago at the University of Washington. And since I'm still single, which is downright pitiful to her, considering I'm the oldest of four kids and the only one who has yet to say I do, she's worried about me. She and Mama both think I'm out here dying of loneliness, which is not true. I mean, I have my days and I have my nights, but I haven't gotten to the point where I'll take whatever I can get. There's a big difference between being thirsty and being dehydrated. But Sheila and Mama have always thought that something was better than nothing, and look where it's gotten them. Mama, who thinks she's an expert on everything, hasn't had a whole man in her life for 17 years. And if I knew where my daddy was, I'd probably kill him for making her such a bitter woman. He broke her heart, and she's never recovered. And Sheila, she files for divorce on an annual basis and calls me collect from some cheap motel where she and the kids are hiding out until she can serve the papers on paw. I listen to her whine for hours about how sick she is of him and that there's nothing he can do or say that would make her go back this time. But then, like a fool, she turns right around and calls him up, repeats her long list of needs that aren't being met, and he promises to give her anything she wants. She refuses to believe him, so he begs on a daily basis for 2 weeks, and by then he's convinced her that he means it, so she gives in and goes on back home. I rarely hear from her while they're honeymooning, except maybe a 3-minute synopsis of how hunky-dory everything is now, and because he's given her permission to go ahead and rip out the old carpet or buy some new dining room furniture, she's watching her money, which is why she can't talk long. One of my brothers is in prison for doing something stupid, passing counterfeit money, but he's not a criminal. And the other one's a lifer in the Marine Corps, so as far as taking advice from any of them goes, I'm skeptical. The deal is the men are dead in Denver, which is only one reason why I'm leaving. I'm tired of this altitude, all this damn snow, and this obsession with the Denver Broncos. For the last 3 years, my life has felt inconsequential, like nobody really gives a damn what I'm doing or how well I do it. From the outside, everything looks good. I've got a decent job, money in the bank, live in a nice condo, and drive a respectable car. I've got everything I need except a man. And I'm not one of these women who thinks that a man is the answer to everything, but I'm tired of being by myself. Being single isn't half as much fun as it used to be.
Terry McMillan, when was being single fun?
When I was in my 20s, before I had my son, before I became a mother.
Because
I didn't care. I wasn't so interested in getting married at the time. I was having a ball.
Uh-huh. And then you became a single mother soon after becoming a mother. And I guess that changed things?
Well, I think once I was in my early 30s, it wasn't just being a mother, to be honest with you. It was being in my 30s. And then I looked up one day and I was 35. And then I was 36, and then 37, and then 38. And then I said, wait a minute. Something is wrong with this picture. So, no, I mean, it's not like I'm miserable. I'm not miserable. But I would prefer that it not be this way. But like Savannah, I'm not ready to take whatever I can get. Because if that's the case, I would have been divorced 5 times by now. Because I have been proposed to. But then I looked at him and said, I don't think so. Not the rest of my life.
Does each of the 4 women in your new novel represent one of your friends or a certain type of woman?
I think more type. No, after having been threatened by a lawsuit for disappearing acts, I made sure. I mean, I even cleared some of these chapters with some of my friends to make sure that they did not feel as if they were being portrayed. But fortunately, women are a lot smarter than men. And a lot of my friends said, don't even worry about it, Terry. I've been in that situation before, and in some instances I was aware of it and some I wasn't. So they just told me, look, you know, a lot of this stuff we all can identify with, so I'm not taking this personally, because I didn't lift my friends' experiences and put them in the book. I made a point of not doing that this time around.
Novelist Terry McMillan is my guest. I'd like to get your reaction to something that David Nicholson wrote in a review of your previous book in the Washington Post. He wrote, McMillan may have created a whole new category, the post-feminist black urban romance novel. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't like to think of my books as romance novels, first of all, but I sort of know what he meant. I think it was meant to be flattering, but I don't like to think of myself as being up there with Danielle Steele and Judith Krantz and the like. I think what he was inferring, at least the way I took it, was that you don't often see romance in novels by black authors. And I deal with sexuality, sensuality, a certain amount of eroticism. And you get to see black men and black women showing and demonstrating a certain amount of passion towards each other, where in a lot of our work it's absent. Not all of our work, because there are other people that do it, but it prevails in my work, because I'm just interested in intimacy, to be honest with you.
Let me ask you about the type of criticism that I think this book might end up getting. One, the criticism that these women are too obsessed with men.
Excuse me. That's a crock of doo-doo. They are not too obsessed with men. The bottom line is that if they were lesbians, they may be more obsessed with women, but it just so happens they're heterosexuals. And I don't think there's anything embarrassing about wanting a companion and wanting to be loved and wanting to love someone. There's nothing embarrassing about that. And, you know, there are too many of us out here right now walking around, parading around. We're living alone. And we're getting by and acting as if it's everything is just okay. But if you had it the way you wanted it, you would not be alone. And I don't see them as being obsessed, because they have other things going on in their lives that they are as concerned about. Their children, their parents, their jobs, you know, their own lives, their bodies, everything. It's not just men, but men fit into the whole picture as well. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
Another criticism I can imagine you getting is that you've made black men look bad.
Are you saying that?
No, I'm saying it's a criticism I can imagine you getting. I'm not criticizing you for it. I'm not saying you did that, but I'm saying, look, on the back of your book, there's a quote from Spike Lee, who's kind of predicting that you're going to get this criticism. I'll read the quote.
You don't have to read it.
No, I'll read it. I've got it right here. He says, "No doubt when this book is published, the author will hear once again, as Zaki Shange did for Colored Girls, Alice Walker for The Color Purple, and Gloria Naylor for The Women of Brewster Place, the cries that the black man has been wronged, the black man has been dogged. I disagree. Terry McMillan has crafted a well-written, truthful, and funny story of 4 African-American women, 4 sisters who are trying to make it in this world we all live in, and the sometimes volatile world of black female, black male relationships." Signed, Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you're anticipating this kind of criticism, or your publisher is.
Well, you know, no, I don't think my publisher was. So far, I'm really kind of surprised. I mean, I've done about maybe 5 readings now, and the brothers are sort of coming up, they wait to the end. until after everybody has asked their questions and made their little comments and stuff, and then they sort of almost eke out, do you think you're going to get criticized? I mean, they haven't, like, jumped on me yet.
What's the origin of that Spike Lee quote? Did the publisher ask him
Spike,
for a quote?
No, Spike read the book, and he said, you know, oh, Terry, you know they're going to jump all over you. And I said, yeah, Spike, I know, but I told a story I wanted to tell, and I'm prepared for it because I'm not going to let the African-American community dictate how I tell a story. And also, when I tell a story, I wish they would just get it once and for all that we, not just myself, but other African-American writers, you know, we're not trying to represent the entire black race. We are telling a story about the characters that inhabit the pages of our book. That's it. You know, and the ones who usually are whining and complaining are the ones who are usually guilty. So I'm not falling for it. I'm just not falling for it. And they can't tell me what to write. And if they don't like it, don't read it. You know, it's some good brothers out here. And the brothers out here who are cool know who they are.
We're featuring an interview with Terry McMillan, recorded in 1992, after the publication of her novel Waiting to Exhale. A new film based on the novel just opened. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with Terry McMillan, the author of Waiting to Exhale. Do you think that there's a different set of problems in black couple relationships than in white couple relationships?
Well, yes and no. I think that all of us have baggage that we bring to a relationship, especially the older we get. I think that black men bring a different kind of baggage. They may bring similar baggage that white men have, but in addition to that, sometimes it's the racial thing. Some of the things that black men have been through, a lot of white men have never experienced. But then again, if we talk about humiliation, there's no color on that. If we talk about helplessness, there's no color on that. But with black men, if the cause of that helplessness is a result of racism, then that's different. Then it's different. But for the most part, a lot of women in general are just sick of being disappointed, sick of men who are afraid of making a commitment, men who are afraid of intimacy, men who lie, men who don't keep their promises. And in that sense, there's no color separation here. I don't know what it's going to take for them to understand that they're missing out on a lot of stuff by being such wusses and being so scared of everything. I mean, there are a lot of really wonderful women and beautiful and smart, intelligent women out here that they seem to be so threatened by and so intimidated by. And, you know, just because we are career women doesn't mean that we still don't want them or love them or care about them or want to share our lives with them. And, it's as if men think that if they fall in love and it doesn't work, that they're going to die, you know?
When you were growing up, did the couples around you, the parents, or, you know, your friends' parents, the aunts and uncles, your parents, the other parents in the neighborhood, did they seem to have good relationships?
A lot of them did. I mean, there were some, I mean, where I grew up, people used to fight. I mean, literally hit each other. In my house, they did. My mother used to hit my father with frying pans, and he'd hit her and punch her lights out and stuff. I mean, violence was, it was almost everywhere. But then again, there were other family members who were more civilized. So I got to see both sides of the coin, and I choose to identify with the kind that was gentle and tender. I saw both, which is why I think I felt this dichotomy. Like, I didn't understand why men and women had to hit each other to make a point. You know, is this the only way you can vent your anger out on each other? And oftentimes, you know, the other person wasn't even the cause of the anger. It was some other stuff. And that's the part that used to baffle me, which is why one time I tried to kill my father for hitting my mother because I knew she hadn't done anything wrong. I don't think we get that as much. I mean, there are still young men out here who think that the only way they can exercise their masculinity is by hitting their wives or their girlfriends. And they don't understand what it does to children when the children have to see this.
What did you do that time when you almost killed your father, when you tried to
kill him? Well, not so much kill him. What I did was, I didn't know where I got the strength from. I literally just picked him up. And I think I was about 9 or 10. I literally ran between him, he and my mother, and I just picked him up by his shirt and threw him up against the wall. I've done it twice. I mean, I stopped a man from stabbing my mother once. I took the knife out of his hand and put it up to his throat and told him if he ever in his life ever thought about hurting my mother again. And I swear to God, I was getting ready to kill him. And I was 13, and I will never forget it. And he thought I was crazy, and I was. But not so much that I did it. But I had that knife puncturing his skin, and I swear to God, I'd have killed him. I just told him, you put your hands on my mother again, you're dead.
Who was he?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter who he was. He wasn't my father.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, alcohol and drugs are usually what precipitates a lot of this action. You rarely see a man sober hitting his wife, unless he's really nuts. Usually it's alcohol or some controlled substance that causes them to go off. That's what I found to be true.
Terry McMillan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Terry McMillan recorded in 1992 after the publication of her novel Waiting to Exhale. She co-wrote the screenplay for the new film adaptation. When we think of women who made an important early contribution to country music, the same names pop up over and over again. Mother Maybelle Carter and Patsy Cline, Kitty Wells and Wanda Jackson. Now a new collection from the Country Music Foundation makes the case for a commonly overlooked woman, Jean Shepherd. This new release, called Honky Tonk Heroine, gathers Shepherd's best recordings made for Capitol Records between 1952 and 1964. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Step out on their wives and do the things they shouldn't do. But it's all right in the public's eye, they say he's just a man. But if a woman does one little thing, she's not worth the two hoops and a holler. She's lower than a hound. If she drinks or smokes or tells a joke, she's the lowest thing in town.
If her hits are to be believed, Jean Shepherd didn't give two whoops and a holler what the country music establishment thought of her. While most women in this genre recorded material that valued devotion to family and the always precarious sanctity of marriage, Shepherd was determined to sing about what she saw as the darker truths. Just listen to this cautionary tale of hard drinking and a ruined marriage, subjects unheard of for a female act in country music in 1953.
You how long I've been drinking and living this honky-tonk life. Well, listen, girls, I'll tell you my story. I'm a mother that was once a happy wife. I'm a girl like so many others, neither good nor bad, maybe a girl like you. And just think, but for the grace of God in heaven, it could have been your heart that was broken too.
During the early part of her career, Jean Shepherd was based on the West Coast, where country music tended to be a little faster and a little wilder. Some of her first recordings featured the intense steel guitar playing of West Coast legend Speedy West, as well as guitar accompaniment by a young Buck Owens. Shepherd herself played the stand-up bass, and when she was discovered by producer Ken Nelson, Nelson says he was impressed by, quote, "This little mite of a girl with this big bass, and she was whacking away, and I liked her, and I signed her."
You've heard that old story ever since time began, that money is the root of all evil. Well, let me tell you mine, it's much older.
Shepherd sang songs that warned the women in her audience not to fall in love with married men and to recognize the disparity between the social freedoms that men and women enjoyed, which for Shepherd often included the right to get loaded and play music just as fast and hard as any man. None of this material was sung with a trace of bitterness, but rather a firmness and common sense clarity. Shepherd's utter lack of self-pity appealed to both male and female country fans. Most of her material, which we would now consider aggressively feminist if sung by any contemporary woman in country music, was written by male songwriters. But it was Shepherd's gift to make the words sound as if they'd just occurred to her.
You say you want to take me out so we can paint the town. Well, I don't care a thing about your kind of running round. The town will go unpainted if you depend on me. Isn't free. You've got a good wife at home. You know she's never been untrue. She's got the whole world of faith and trust and confidence in you. How you can be unfaithful, I just can't understand. Now why don't you go home to your wife and act like a married man?
Jean Shepherd is still alive. She celebrated her 40th year as a member of Nashville's Grand Ole Opry in November. She deserves a lot more credit than she's gotten for combining a progressive sensibility with beautifully crafted, go-for-broke honky-tonk music. And she did it with a sense of abandon that no other woman in this genre has conveyed as fully since then.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is our land. Our last moment of bliss, darling, our love can never be right.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with actor Michael J. Fox about his relationship with the camera. He grew up in front of it, but when he started a family of his own, the paparazzi wouldn't get out of the way. Fox co-stars in the new movie, The American President. Also, a review of the new film adaptation of Othello. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After starring in a few box office disappointments, Michael J. Fox is in a hit, The American President. His character, a domestic policy advisor, appears to be modeled on George Stephanopoulos. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we have a 1993 interview with Michael J. Fox. He became famous for his role as Alex Keaton on Family Ties and for the Back to the Future movies. He's made a couple of surprising choices in his career. In addition to commercial comedies, he's done a couple of complex dramatic films, Brian De Palma's Casualties of War, set in Vietnam, and Paul Schrader's Light of Day, a movie about a brother-sister rock band co-starring Joan Jett.
I'm proud of those choices, and I'm proud of those movies. I wish that I could take credit for some kind of grand vision and say, well, yeah, you know, I felt it. It was good to have this juxtaposition, and well, I really didn't. I read scripts, and I said, wow, really? I can do this? You'll let me? Terrific.
Now, why do you think they sent you the scripts? Because you were known as a comic actor, and these were both dramas, and I know, like in Hollywood, there's so much typecasting. Why do you think they thought of you?
It's hard to get into the minds of other people.
Yeah, right.
It's
really probably, especially in Hollywood, right?
Especially in Hollywood, and you don't even want to go there, and you don't want to go there alone. But I think there are a lot of different reasons, and a lot of people have different agendas. Sometimes it's purely commercial. People say, I would love to attach that name to my project, whatever its suitability, because it could bring a heightened return on my investment. I think that other people, have a pure belief in your ability and say, yeah, this guy can do it. And they want to be the person that bets on the winning horse. They want to be the person that's right, in that regard. And I think also some people are forced into it. And, some people, so any one
forced
of those...
Forced into it, like choose someone from the A-list?
Right, exactly. And yeah. Any one of those factions can be campaigning and lobbying. So as an actor, it does you no good in the long run to think about that.
I want to talk with you a little bit about your background. You grew up in Canada. Your father was in the Canadian Army, and then he was with the Edmonton Police?
Actually, the Delta Police in British Columbia. He was a dispatcher.
Oh, okay.
Which my father loved the police. He loved that lifestyle. He was too old to be an active policeman by the time he had finished his term in the service. But he used to say his job was to say, "Go get 'em, boys." He really loved that.
So was he a disciplinarian at home?
He was in many ways, and yet in other ways he gave you a lot of room. 1,700 hours, sit at the dinner table and don't be late and all that good stuff. But at the same time, this is a man who, when I was 17 years old, allowed me to drop out of high school because high school wouldn't give me room to do theater at night and to do the television work that I was doing. And my father's way of thinking was that from my socioeconomic background, it's not like I was going to the University of British Columbia and becoming a physiotherapist or a lawyer. I mean, that wasn't going to happen. So in his way of thinking, if I was happy and I had found a vocation that interested me and I was getting a check, that he would do everything he could to support me. And in fact, my father drove me down to Los Angeles on his credit card, picked up the gas and all that stuff.
You were how old when you got Family Ties?
I was 20 years old.
20?
Yeah.
So how'd you get the part?
Well, that was a long, involved story. I was at this point destitute. I mean, I had...
Destitute or in debt? You're in debt, right?
I was both, yeah. I had no phone. I had no furniture. I was ducking the landlord. I was eating plain wrap macaroni and tuna. And I owed the IRS some money. And I was in a tough spot. And I knew that at that point, it was time to go back to Canada. But I really felt that I could do something. And I said to my agent, because I had always resisted going in to read for sitcoms, but I said, at this point, I'm so desperate, I'll do anything. Send me in for sitcoms. Send me in for everything. And I went in and read for Family Ties. Gary Goldberg hated me, didn't want to see me again. Judith Wiener was insistent that he was missing the point with me. And after about 5 weeks, he had me come in again. And I read for him. Gary Goldberg is the executive producer. I read for him again, and immediately he became my champion. He took me to the network. He fought for me very hard because they were resistant. And then they hired me. We did the pilot. Brandon Tartikoff wanted to fire me again, said to Gary. And this is by Brandon's own admission. I didn't know this until several years later, and he kind of came to me and said, you want to know what an idiot I am? This is what I was trying to do, and you didn't even know about it. He had approached Gary and said, look, the kid's all right, but can you see his face on a lunchbox? And Gary said, well, you know, I'd never thought that that was, you know, the criterion for you know, hiring actors. He said, look, Brandon, all I know is I write the kid two jokes. He gets me three laughs. You can't take this kid away from me. And so they kept me around, and ultimately it paid off.
The show is, I think, supposed to be about the parents first, you know, the hippie parents in the 80s, you know, 20 years later in the 80s. But the show ended up being more about you and Justine Bateman. How can you feel, when did you start to feel that change happening?
Well, almost from the beginning. When we did the pilot for Family Ties, I saw, not in anything that I was doing, but I saw in the character, I just saw an energy and also a relevance and this weird accessibility that I don't think many people saw. I said, well, I know these guys. I mean, I hang out at UCLA and these guys exist, you know, much to my fear and my dread, that there was that wave, that whole Reagan youth thing starting to happen. And they had written a funny character, and they had written a lot of funny contradictions and a lot of ironies within this character. And so we did the pilot, and I kind of knew that he was, that if we went on, he would kind of start to move center stage. And it wasn't anything I was trying to manipulate or cause to happen. I just knew. And what I knew about writers was they will write to where the laughs are. And they will write for you know, the character that provides the most laughs. And again, I wasn't trying to step forward and do that. I just kind of knew, and I would know every week, and I would step back and I'd go, damn. I mean, they howled at that stuff. And next week there'd be more lines and more lines, and it just kind of progressed from there.
Was it hard as you kept getting older for the character to still be at home and in high school? Because it took him a while to get to college.
Yeah, it was... you know, it was kind of weird at 27 to be saying, Mallory, get off the phone. You know? it was getting old, and we all knew it, you know, and that was one of the reasons, why, you know, it was, we all decided in the seventh season that was it, you know, that we couldn't really do anymore, that it wasn't fair. You know, I kind of felt like we were just taking people for a ride if we'd gone much beyond that. You know, it was, to me, the peak season, the best season of Family Ties will always be the fifth season. For a lot of reasons, it was the season that my wife now came on the show, and it was.
This is Tracy Pollan.
Tracy Pollan, yeah, and I think, you know, that's just when it, you know, kind of kicked to another level, and also it was we were then in the full swing of the whole kind of Back to the Future, Cosby Show, this whole thing that was happening. We were in this great time slot, and I had this whole other thing happening with a film career, and it just got into this other energy where we just. It was like that championship season, you know. It was just the year that it was great. And after that, we were kind of, you know, I think we were still doing a quality show, but, it, you know, that was its moment.
So did you and Tracy Pollan start to fall in love on the set?
We actually didn't. We were both involved in different relationships. I had a crush on her. There's no question of that. I thought she was unbelievable and such a good actress. And it wasn't until I did Bright Lights, Big City, and she read for it. And we had this conversation, and I said, you know, so how's it going with so-and-so? And she, you know, she said, well, we're not together anymore. And I was like, okay, let's have to, what do I do here? Okay, quick, you know, say something, say the right thing immediately. And it wasn't a year later that we were married.
It must be really awkward in a way to start developing a relationship with someone when you're working with them on a movie.
Right.
Do you try to keep it quiet from everybody else?
Yeah, you try to do that whole thing. And then there's also the whole kind of, you know, tabloid level interest in what you do. And so you kind of have, you spend a lot of time, you know, running through Central Park, you know, away from photographers and just bizarre stuff. And you stop and go, why am I doing this? Why do I even care?
You actually wrote a really funny article in Esquire magazine about what it was like to get married with all the paparazzi and all the tabloids wanting to be part of the wedding and you wanting to keep them out.
Well, I had the good luck to have Michael Pollan as my brother-in-law, who's the executive editor at Harper's and a terrific writer. And just to kind of backtrack and set it up, we got married at this little inn in Vermont. And I've always understood that you know, if people in the public eye get married and they have, you know, 14 elephants and, you know, camels and, you know, people, you know, you swing up on a golden, chandelier and, you know, and it costs $500,000, there's a certain amount of spectacle there, and you expect it to get some kind of coverage, and it would be hypocritical at that point to say, well, okay, hey, leave us alone, you know.
It's just a little personal event.
But this was like 40 people at an inn in Arlington, Vermont.
Yeah.
And, you know, we literally had a record player and we, you know, rolled back the rugs and we had like jug wine and beer, you know. It was a pretty low-key deal. So when this giant contingent of the tabloid press showed up and demanded that their rights be served and that they get to, you know, they get to cover the event on behalf of our fans, I immediately said, well, anyone who would sanction this, I'm happily, you know, I won't take their money anymore. They can keep their $7. I don't need them. And it just was so hilarious. I mean, if it was just a little intrusive, I think I would have been more angry. But it was so kind of biblical. It was just insane.
Would you have helicopters?
Well, there were helicopters. There was one group of photographers that were trying to find a llama suit because there were llamas on the grounds of this inn, and they thought if they put on a llama suit, they could infiltrate. There were, these helicopters. There were people. They had the National Enquirer had their central command in the same hotel that where we spent our first night of marriage, you know. It was just insane. We were checking for parabolic microphones. It became so comic. We went down to on our honeymoon down to the Caribbean, and we had this terrific villa on the water. And we arrived at night, and I'll never forget the morning that I woke up, and there was these big louvered windows, and I opened them up, you know, to look at the view, and there were three boats, 50 feet offshore, with like 500mm lenses, you know, pointed at us. And we went, this is surreal. And we went to Martha's Vineyard, and because we decided to escape that, and we went to Martha's Vineyard, and a frogman literally came out of the water and finally got the photograph that they've been trying to get. And then the capper to the whole thing was that we literally got bad reviews, that magazines like People and whatnot just savaged our wedding, just kind of not only said, how dare you, you know, try to get married and not have us be part of it, but also we hear it really sucked. We hear it was terrible, you know, and this projection, it was so clear, it was so adolescent, it was so, you know, this is just the most insane teenage projection that I've ever seen. And I sat back and I said, I don't even know how you rebut this, or whether you want to, or how you respond to it. And I was talking to Michael about it, and he said, write it, just write it down, because someone will want to hear it. And so it became this piece.
Something that interested me in the story, apparently when People magazine said, you know, if you give us the exclusive, you know, blah, blah,
right.
blah.
They said, they offered us the Bert and Lonnie deal. and we now see what happens when you take the Bert and Lonnie deal.
Well, what happens?
Well, you become partners. Well, you become partners with the media in the most private element of your life. You've got to, you know, I think the reason that I'm so happy is that I was always able to kind of keep a separation there, and sometimes it's difficult, and sometimes nasty things are said about you, and so, you know, whatever. But you have to kind of go, well, that's not real. I have to keep my world in some ways as small as possible.
It's part of the deal that if you let in a magazine and give them exclusive rights, they'll give you a good review for the wedding.
Basically,
and if you don't let them in, all bets are off.
That's essentially what happened. Yeah, and like I said, the other thing that happens. I mean, like, it really does become so juvenile and silly. I mean, to this day, I have, you know, back and forths with these people. I think currently I'm divorced in the latest Globe. And, you know, they call you and they say, you care to rebut this? And you say, no, read my lips. I'm not going to get in any confirmation denial relationship with you. I mean, what's the point? If I deny it, you'll characterize it as a, you know, this denial, and you'll wrap it up. And, I mean, you know, it's like these things they do on A Current Affair where they videotape someone, and because nothing was said, what they do is they run it in slow motion so that it looks suspicious and nasty no matter what you do. It's just so insane that to even become party to it is just a waste of your time.
I love on those shows how they keep, since they only have like 3 inches of footage, they keep rerunning it over and over.
Right. And it's always that really slow motion
like
thing with furtive little eye glance, you know. taking out the trash, making taking out the trash look like dumping bodies off the Brooklyn Bridge.
My guest is Michael J. Fox. He's currently starring in The American President. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our 1993 interview with Michael J. Fox. I want to ask you about Casualties of War, the film set in Vietnam, where you star with Sean Penn, and the platoon goes on this mission, and he basically kidnaps a young Vietnamese woman, midway through the mission, there's a gang rape that your character refuses to participate in, and you try to save her. I'm interested in what it was like for you to work with Sean Penn, because you appear to be such different kinds of actors, and one would think that you have really different approaches to, you know, how you prepare for a scene and what you're like in a scene when you're shooting. So I'm wondering if there's anything that clashed about that, or...
Well, there was actually no clash, but there was complete and total difference in the way we work.
Yeah.
When we finished the movie, and we went out for dinner in Bangkok, and I gave Sean a gift, and there was a card, and I hope you won't mind me saying this, but on the card I had written, Sean, I can't say that it was a pleasure, but it was certainly a privilege, which is the way I felt about it. Sean and I have completely different approaches to the way we work. And I think that Sean is a tremendous actor with an amazing energy. And when we met originally and talked about doing the film together, you know, we're very open and we kind of said what we were going to do. And Sean, as much as said, I am this guy. From the moment I get on the plane, I am this guy. And I said, I'm not, you know. So we kind of agreed to go our own ways in that way. And so that when we shot the film, and much has been made of this, but it actually was like a non-event. We, very little outside of working, talked very little and discussed what we were doing very little because it was counterproductive. There was no sense in doing it. I like to work from the story out. From the story in to the character. And Sean prefers to look at it the other way. Having said that, what's really great about the way Sean worked is that he never once impinged upon anything, any choice I made with the way he did his work, which is to say, even though we played enemies, his approach to that is have minimal contact. A kind of an irresponsible approach to that style of work would be to be intrusive with my process in the way that his character might. And that would be irresponsible, and that I would, you know, go like this and say, wait a minute, you know, that's not the way it's going to work. And we've got to make some changes here. But it was never like that. Sean did his work, and I did my work, and I think that it worked well.
I have a friend who likes to say that whole film kind of takes place on your face, because as the drama unfolds, as your character is exposed to all these horrors, your character is just changing and reacting to what he sees. Mm-hmm. And what registers on your face is kind of crucial to... Right. What happens visually in the film. And I was wondering how conscious you were of that, and if it put, you know, different demands on you than anything you had done before.
Yeah, it was a very demanding film in that way. And again, you know, with comedy, I am most comfortable with comedy. And I think it's also because I have a real technical understanding of comedy. I mean, comedy, you can break it down. You can say, you know, you say things in threes, they're funny. If you hit the K, it's funny. Cucumber is funny. Certain things are funny. Dramatic moments and dramatic punchlines, if you will, are much more elusive, and it's much more just what happens. So you have to... I don't have a real technique for that. The only thing that I can do is be available to what's happening. The great thing about Casualties of War was, from a performance point of view, was that the environment was such, and the things that were being acted out were such that that stuff was very available. I mean, this girl screaming was, I think, heightened by the fact that it was in Vietnamese and that we were all hot. It was 120 degrees. A lot of us were dysenteric. We were homesick. We had bites on us and welts. We had gone through basic training. We had done all these things. And so in that way, it was a real emotional experience. There wasn't, I found that when I felt the compulsion to act, I stifled it. I said, forget about it. I don't want to do that. Sean's performance, and rightly so, was a very outward and a very kind of forceful performance. And I thought that what Erickson should be is very quiet and very confused. He's not out there to push any agenda. He doesn't have an agenda. His agenda is just to get through this. He didn't know what to expect. He thought he was going on a camping trip. He just, you know, got a thing in the mail, said get on a plane and, you know, do this thing. And it's just, so I just thought, just sit back and let this stuff happen. And I think that it did.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
Michael J. Fox recorded in 1993. He's currently co-starring in The American President. This is Fresh Air. The first movie version of Shakespeare's Othello in 30 years is, not too surprisingly, multicultural. Oliver Parker's adaptation features an African-American Othello, Lawrence Fishburne, a British Iago, Kenneth Branagh, and a French Desdemona, Irene Jacob. Guest film critic Steve Weinberg has a review.
Othello may have more dramatic urgency than any of Shakespeare's other tragedies, including Macbeth. A good production easily restores the child viewer in us, who aches to stop the action before the villain succeeds in ensnaring the hero. The British film from the mid-60s, starring Laurence Olivier, is devastating enough to bring you to your knees, and the flamboyant Orson Welles adaptation has its own special potency. There have been four other movie versions, including a German silent, a Russian talkie, a ballet, and a rock musical. But the latest, with Lawrence Fishburne as the duped Moor and Kenneth Branagh as the ensign who destroys him by framing his innocent wife for adultery, isn't gripping. It isn't a disaster either, you keep watching, but the power of the play dribbles away in the final third when most Othellos tighten the noose around your neck. The main problem isn't in the heavy cuts the adapter director Oliver Parker has made to the text. Welles eliminated at least as much. It isn't in his strange throwaway choices, like having Othello pause to wash his face before smothering Desdemona. Or even his silly cinematic ones, like Othello's nightmare or the images he can't get out of his head of his wife in bed with her alleged lover, Cassio. Parker's Othello fantasizes in a lurid montage of body parts that echoes the worst excesses of Franco Zeffirelli, who filmed the flower child Romeo and Juliet in the 60s. This is one tragedy that can withstand all these assaults. What it probably can't survive is poor casting. Lawrence Fishburne, his head shaven, makes a visually striking Moor, but he reads the verse inexpressively, slowly, cautiously, with a flat clarity and a not-too-assured West Indian accent. His responses to Iago's insinuations about Desdemona, to the rigged evidence, and even to his own discovery of the truth when it's too late, are oddly muted, as if he didn't quite get it. Irene Jacob, the beautiful French actress who plays Desdemona, seems equally benumbed. except for one lovely vivid moment when she sings in her bath while preparing for bed. Aside from Nathaniel Parker, who brings an unusual complexity to Cassio's drunk scene, the only actor in the movie who does anything interesting is Kenneth Branagh as Iago. A superb technician, Branagh works the verse as deftly as Iago works Othello.
Good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse, steals trash, 'tis something, nothing, 'twas mine, 'tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him, and makes me poor indeed.
By heaven, I'll know thy thought.
You cannot if my harp were in your hand, nor shall not while 'tis in my custody. Oh, beware, my lord, of jealousy. 'Tis the green-eyed monster that doth mock the meat it feeds on.
Branagh picks simple jealousy as the character's motivating force. He wanted to be Othello's lieutenant, a position the Moor has bestowed on Cassio. And his choice makes this Iago less mysterious and haunting than others I've seen, like Frank Finlay opposite Olivier, or the explosive young black actor Andre Brouwer on stage. But Branagh's Iago has the menace of a master warrior and the brilliantly feigned loyalty of a master actor. You feel sure you'd fall for his story, too.
Steve Weinberg writes for the Boston Phoenix and teaches at College of the Holy Cross. Today's archive edition of Fresh Air was produced by Roberta Shirock. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Kathy Wolf and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a Merry Christmas.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Farrar, Straus & Giroux, publisher of Sophie's World, a novel about the history of philosophy. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.
A new film adaptation of Othello stars Lawrence Fishburne and Kenneth Branagh. On the next Fresh Air, we'll feature interviews with each of them. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.